Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. So I sometimes feel like a bit of an imposter in the libertarian world because I love learning about these, you know, grand economic principles, but my eyes really start to glaze over when I hear people talk about, you know, numbers and fractional reserve banking and cryptocurrency and bimetallism and that kind of stuff. So, but I suspect I'm not the only libertarian who has that problem, right? So not all of us can be, you know, money nerds, right? There's that whole division of labor thing. So, but that's why I've invited Mike Meharry on to help folks like me bridge that gap. And this is basically our Money for Dummies episode. And Mike is the former host of the Godarchy podcast, which is now archived through the Christians for Liberty Network. So you can check that out. You probably recognize him from that. But if you don't, you got to go back and listen to the back catalog. There's great stuff there. And I'm not saying that because he interviewed me once. And he's currently a reporter and analyst for Money Metals Exchange and the communications director for the 10th Amendment Center. And I wish we could talk about the 10th Amendment Center today because that's really interesting, but we're just doing money today, but maybe we'll have you back to do that at some point. So Mike, thanks for being here to talk with me.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. Although I'm not sure how cool it is to be the Money for Dummies guy. Does that make me the dummy here or?
No. Yeah. I don't want to speak for everyone listening. I certainly am the dummy. So you are. I'm your Padawan and you are the master, or there's always two, as they say. So this will be helpful, hopefully for me, but also for a lot of folks like me. So let's start at the most basic level. What is money? Why did humans start using it?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that's almost obscured in this day and age, because I think most people think of money as like being its own thing. And money is really just representative of something, and what it really represents when you boil it all down is labor. Money is a way of storing and transferring wealth, which is ultimately produced by our labor, if that makes sense. So money serves two basic roles in an economy. Number one, it is a store of value. It is a store of wealth. If you labor and you produce, let's say you grow apples, you produced apples, you've created this wealth, you can sell those apples to somebody else, and they will give you money in exchange. And that money really just symbolizes your labor that's been passed on to you as you've exchanged the product of that labor to that other person. The second role of money is to store that wealth. So when we have money, we can take something that we produced a long time ago and we sell it and we have the money that will store that value until we want to spend it and get something else of it. So basically two functions, medium of exchange, and then also a store of value. So really it is the kind of lubricant, it's the transfer that makes the economy work. Almost like if you think of it like wires, it allows us to exchange goods and services with each other in a more efficient and seamless way than if we didn't have money and, you know, I was growing apples and I needed shoes, so I had to find a shoemaker who wanted apples. I don't have to do that when there's money involved. I can sell my apples to whoever wants them for money, and then I can take that money and go find the shoemaker and buy my shoes.
Well, so when you say that money represents labor, what happens in my head is I sort of think, okay, well, that means that labor is worth a certain amount of money. There's this idea, what they call the labor theory of value, that the labor that you do has a certain value to it. And so, you know, someone like Adam Smith actually famously said this, but also someone like Karl Marx would say, you know, the amount of work that it takes to produce a, you know, microphone is how much it's worth. And anything you charge beyond that is surplus value that is essentially stolen, right? So, I mean, so when you say that money represents labor, is there like kind of a clear one-to-one correspondence there?
No, absolutely not. Because you're kind of conflating, or not you only, but people do this all the time. It's conflating two different things, right? Value is absolutely independent of really anything. Value is determined not by what is put into something. Value is purely subjective. And the whole labor theory of value. So that's the idea that, you know, if I make a cake and my labor is worth a certain amount, then that cake carries that value of labor. No, absolutely not. Because if I go out and spend 3 hours making mud pies, nobody's going to buy them because they have absolutely no value in anybody else's, well, I assume. I mean, maybe there's somebody out there that wants mud pies. But so value is subjective. Value is different from person to person. You know, I really, really like goalie sticks. I would pay a lot of money for a good goalie stick. I'm going to guess you probably wouldn't pay a dime for a good goalie stick, right? It has no value to you. So that's what we mean when value is subjective. So the actual value or the price of something isn't determined by anything extrinsic. It's all based on what the various parties involved, how they value it personally. So this idea that there's excess value and all that stuff, it's that whole thing falls apart when you just think about mud pies. But when I say that the labor, that money represents your labor, what I'm saying is that when somebody says, you know, I value what you've produced or the work that you're willing to do at a certain amount, money allows us to make that transaction. It allows us to transfer that perceived value in real terms, if that makes sense. So it's a little bit convoluted, I guess, but value is kind of its own independent thing and is determined by the parties that are involved in any transaction. It's not something that has an absolute number to it.
It's kind of what it's worth to the person who might be interested in buying it.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, so if I write a PhD thesis on a queer reading of, you know, Isaiah or something, and nobody wants to buy that, doesn't matter how many hours I spent on it or how much research I did. That's, yeah, okay. So the money becomes sort of a way of transferring, kind of labor in a sense, right? So there's this idea, though, I think people say, you know, we could just barter. And then the problem there becomes, well, if you're just bartering, then if I've got apples and you've got bananas and I want bananas and you don't want apples, then there's that creates a complication, right? So money comes in as a sort of kind of like a middleman to sort of transfer that value. So that's kind of, I don't want to say this, something that's kind of more neutral, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That you hit the nail on the head. It's why we evolved from a barter economy to a money economy, because like I kind of alluded to as I was explaining what money is, right? If I'm growing apples and I want to get shoes and the shoemaker doesn't want apples, well, then we have a problem, right? I mean, he's not going to take something that he doesn't want. Again, value is subjective. So I need to find that thing that he wants. And let's say he wants oranges. Well, I don't have oranges. So money solves that problem because then we don't have to find the thing that they want. We can all agree that this is going to be the medium of exchange and we can just deal in that. And it solves this problem of finding a willing partner for the things that we want and or the things that we need.
So where do banks come into this? I mean, I've got, you know, money stored in my, you know, wallet or my glove compartment or whatever. Why do I need a bank? How do banks come into this, all these transactions here that are happening?
Well, banks kind of rose out of convenience. I mean, you don't have to have a bank in order to have a viable economy. Banks make things more convenient. For one thing, banks can store money over time. So, you know, especially if you're thinking about like a hard currency situation where you've got gold or silver, well, you don't want to carry, you know, 100 pounds of gold around with you everywhere. You need a place to store that. Banks provided that secure storage facility and then kind of allow people to transfer money more easily. But they're not absolutely necessary in a monetary system. And then, of course, really the function of banks in a modern financial system really has more to do with lending and borrowing than it actually does with storing money. But yeah, we can get by perfectly well with just using cash or gold or seashells if that's what we determine is going to be our medium of exchange. So banks are kind of, I don't want to say superfluous because they are very important in the financial system, but they're not integral for it. And they basically arised again out of convenience to allow people to store money and, not have to carry around wheelbarrows of cash for big transactions.
And so the lending function of banks probably kind of comes later, sort of evolves, because essentially they're just sort of storing especially large amounts of money,
right?
Initially, and then lending comes later. So you know, my guess would be that it's something like, you know, they're charging a fee to store, and then they start kind of lending out money based on those fees to try to get money back. But at a certain point, something happens where they maybe start lending out. They sort of go, well, maybe people aren't always coming in to pick up this money that we're storing. So maybe we'll lend out some of the money that we're holding for somebody that's not really ours. and that becomes another sort of function that sounds illegal and unethical, but it's essentially what banks do, right?
Right. Yeah. And what you're talking about is fractional reserve banking. So in the US financial system, I believe it's 10% that a bank has to hold. It has to have at least 10% of the assets that it has lended out. Now, obviously, if everybody comes back and demands their money at one time, there's a big problem because that money doesn't exist. The bank only has 10% of it. Thus, we had bank runs, which were pretty ubiquitous in the earlier days of America. So, yeah, that's and you know, there's a lot of debate about fractional reserve banking. You'll have some people say it's absolutely integral and it really is fine. You'll have other people say no, it's immoral because they're literally lending out money that doesn't exist. You know, I kind of fall in the middle on that. I think that if everybody agrees that this bank is going to be a fractional reserve bank and they're only going to hold 10% of what they lend out, that's all well and good. But everybody should be well aware that that bank could fail. And the problem is that nobody wants the banks to fail. So then you end up with bailouts and government intervening. And that's the problem. So no matter how you slice it, I think we would be much better with a freer market in money as opposed to what we have today.
Yeah, because after these bank runs start happening in the Great Depression, we develop, I think it's called FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And that sort of, it's the government guaranteeing some of those funds so that if a bank, you know, goes down the toilet, those who have lent money to those banks are supposed to be able to get some of that back, right? And so this kind of whole system of kind of fractional reserve banking, it's kind of like this idea that we have like an economy that's built largely on credit, not necessarily on money that we have in hand, but that, you know, I'm good for it. You know, the US bank is good for the money. We may not have it on hand right now, but there's this kind of system we've developed and we sort of know that, you know, nobody comes in and asks, we don't have everybody coming in and asking for 100% of the money in a day. So we have some amount of confidence that we can do this with some success and it's going to be okay. And we're trusted on credit. And that's, and then we've kind of built a largely an economy on credit basically. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the American economy is really more of a financial system than it is an actual economy. You know, if you think of an economy, the reality of the of an economy is goods and services, right? It's stuff that people are producing. It's stuff that people are doing. It's real things. And then we have this financial system that's kind of layered over top of that, that is designed to facilitate the real economy. But over the last, you know, I'd say in my lifetime, we've seen a much more of an evolution toward a financial economy where so much of what happens really involves banking and lending and, you know, mergers and acquisitions as opposed to being focused on producing stuff and providing services. And I think that's really to our detriment. I think we would be much better off as a society if the focus remained on the real economy and we focused on providing goods and services to our neighbors, as opposed to, you know, all of these financial manipulations that go on in the financial system. Quite frankly, I think that at some point, the financial system as it exists will not exist anymore because it's unsustainable. And at that point, you're going to have some kind of reset where we go back to a real economy. It's going to be a painful thing, but I think ultimately it would serve society much better than what we have today.
Yeah, well, and we'll get into kind of central banking and stuff like that at some point, but kind of what you're describing is very much sort of how the United States government functions. It functions largely on credit and is kind of printing money it doesn't really have. But there's this sort of expectation, well, we're good for it, right? So we'll get into that at some point. But okay, so we at some point have hard money, like gold. The nice thing about gold is it's, you know, not plentiful. So like, you know, if we used, you know, something like seashells, as you mentioned earlier, the problem there is maybe it's too plentiful, especially if you're near the coast.
Right.
And so it's not really worth much. It's an inflated currency, so to speak. There's just too much of it. And so it's hard for it to have any real value. But gold is successful as money because it's rare-ish. You know, there's only so much of it. And you can transport it up to a certain point. You know, at a certain point, you have too much. Maybe you need to get a bank to hold it for you. So how do we go from that hard money like gold or silver to paper money? What changes to make that happen?
Well, the first step was actually, I would argue, probably a good step. And that was the fact that you had these banks and we had a hard money system where gold and silver were literally the money. And so banks were holding the gold and silver. And people realized that, hey, you know, hauling around gold bars and silver bars, they're heavy, they're clumsy. I've got this gold that's in this bank that's stored. Why don't I just write a note to you that basically transfers ownership of the gold that's in that bank to you? And so that made it much easier to transact business. And so in effect, those bank notes were paper money. And so once I had that bank note, you know, I could go to the bank and get the gold, or I could just say, hey, I've got this bank note. It's worth this amount of gold that's in XYZ bank. I can just give it to Bob. And so eventually, we ended up with a situation where paper was circulating more than the actual gold and silver, but it was still backed by the gold and silver. There was a time when there had to be all of the gold and silver, you know, had to be in that bank vault, and it had to be available for the people with this note to be able to go claim it. But then over time, we ended up with the fractional reserve system, and people realized, well, no, everybody's not going to come for the gold at the same time. So maybe we can issue a little bit more paper than there was gold. So that's really where things started to kind of go off the rails. And we saw in the early years of the United States, you know, in the 1800s, we saw these bank runs where, you know, they had issued too much paper relative to the amount of hard currency that they had. And then eventually it kind of evolved, and we ended up with this dollar system in the U.S. economy. But up until the 1930s, that dollar had to be backed by a certain amount of gold that was held in the Federal Reserve System, in the central bank. And that was okay. I mean, it kind of limited the amount of money that the government could issue because they had to have X amount of gold. So in order to issue more notes, they had to get more gold. Well, in the 1930s, when we had the Great Recession, we had FDR as the president, and he was doing all of these, you know, Keynesian stimulus programs, and the government was spending money hand over fist. Well, they started to run out of gold, and they needed to create more currency, but the law prevented them from doing that because they didn't have enough gold. So the first thing that Roosevelt did was he tried to confiscate everybody's gold. I don't like to use the word confiscation because nobody came door to door and taking people's gold. They basically said, hey, you need to give up your gold. And quite frankly, a lot of people are like, okay. So they did, right? The fact of the matter is a lot of people did not, but that's a whole different story that we don't necessarily need to get into. But it wasn't confiscation in the true sense of the word, but it did drastically increase the federal government's gold holdings. And then that allowed to further print money. And so then the next thing they did was they changed the dollar peg. So at one point, $1 was worth, I'm trying to think of what the numbers were, $20, 1 ounce of gold. And then so FDR said, well, wait a minute, why don't we just make it $35 as an ounce of gold? So instant inflation of the money supply. It allowed them to print more money. And so that was the end of the gold standard. The bottom line is that a gold standard, a hard money standard, where it is limited, you know, you talked about the scarcity, that's one of the important attributes of money. Gold is scarce. So therefore, when your dollar is backed by gold or whatever your currency is, that means that they can't create more of them without getting more gold. Well, that's inconvenient to government because government needs to inflate. Government needs to print money in order to grow itself, in order to do all of the things that we think government needs to do for us. And so then over time, government's basically just said, you know what? Let's get rid of this gold standard. And then that will allow us unfettered printing privileges. And FDR set us on that path. And then in 1971, Richard Nixon severed the last tie between the American dollar and gold. And now today we have what is known as a fiat currency. It is literally backed by nothing. And the federal government can theoretically create as many dollars as it wants to. It has no restrictions. There's no gold standard. There's nothing. It's just paper and a printing press. So that's kind of the evolution. And I think the key point in that is that the reason we had this evolution is because the government needs fiat currency. It needs an unfettered printing press in order for it to grow and become more powerful. I often will say that the Federal Reserve, which is the primary instrument of money creation in the United States, is the engine that drives the biggest government in the history of the world. If we did not have a central bank, if we did not have the Federal Reserve effectively backstopping the borrowing and spending with money printing, the federal government wouldn't be able to grow and do all the things that it does. So if you're really, really mad at the warfare and the welfare state, really the finger pointing should ultimately be at the Federal Reserve, because it's the enabler.
Well, and so this question may make me sound like a 5-year-old or Bernie Sanders, but if paper money is basically made up, as you said, why can't we just print enough to take care of everybody's needs, make everybody rich?
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool? Or you know, conversely, even with the gold standard, I've heard people say, you know, there's apparently this meteor that they found that has like 16 trillion tons of gold on it, or you know, something ridiculous like that. I made that number up, but it's a lot of gold. We were trillions of dollars, and then everybody could just be rich because we have all of this gold. But you have to remember that money is relative. And I can't take credit for this analogy. It actually came from Thomas Massey, but it really kind of visualizes what happens. If you have a glass of Coca-Cola, good old Coke, and you take a pitcher of water, you know, let's say your glass is half full of Coke, so you've got pure Coke. Well, if you take that pitcher of water and fill the glass the rest of the way up, what does it do to the Coke? It dilutes it, right? There's not as much Coke in that glass as there originally was. Well, I mean, there's the same amount of Coke, but we've increased the amount of liquid, but it's still just the same amount of Coke. Same thing happens when you print money. And you think about it like this. Let's say a donut's a dollar. All right. Let's say that's it. There's only one thing in the economy. It's one donut, and we have $1. That's our economy. One donut, $1. Now, let's say that somebody comes along and says, ooh, I'm going to be rich. I'm going to make $2. Well, you still only got one donut. So that, you know, if that's the only things in the economy, the donut was worth a dollar. Well, when you print $2, well, now the donut's $2. You're not any richer. You just have more of this paper. You don't have any more stuff. And that's the key that people have to remember. You always have to relate money with stuff. It's not its own thing. So if you increase the amount of money without increasing the amount of stuff, all you're doing is effectively raising the price of the stuff. And so, you know, that's where we are today. And the Bernie Sanders of the world, you know, they will try to tell you that, oh yeah, we can print because of this reason and that reason. Well, yeah, you can. But what it's going to do is it's going to make everything that you want cost more. And we saw that in spades after the coronavirus pandemic. We had a situation where the Federal Reserve literally created out of thin air nearly $5 trillion in new money. We had a bunch of people that weren't producing anything because they were locked in their houses, but they had the internet so they could still spend the money that the government was showering on them. Well, what happened? Prices spiked. So that's an inevitable consequences. Not consequences, one consequence. It's the inevitable consequence of money creation is you're going to have increasing consumer prices. Now, here's the catch. It's beneficial for the first people to get the money, right? So if you've got, you know, a stable price system, and then you create another $100 and you hand that $100 to Joe over here. Well, now Joe can access all of those prices with his new money. So he actually does benefit. He is richer in a sense. But as the economy equalizes, then the prices will rise to meet that money level. And the people that get the money later, they don't get the benefit. They end up with this rising price situation, but they don't have the extra $100. And so who are the people who get the first money in the US financial system? It's the bankers and the government. So you can see where the benefit is. Ain't you and it ain't me.
So then the problem with counterfeiters is that people are benefiting who aren't the government or their friends.
Exactly. And that's literally the only difference.
Right. So you mentioned the Federal Reserve a little bit. You talked about printing money. So, you know, I guess my question is, who decides how much money exists? So I guess at one point there wasn't a Federal Reserve Bank, and I guess Congress would make that decision. And so then what does adding the Federal Reserve or a central bank do to that process? And I mean, are they the ones who decide? Is Congress the one who decides? What's that relationship look like?
Well, it's not really, in one sense, it's not exactly a decision. I mean, it's somewhat incumbent upon markets operating, right? So when you have a fractional reserve system like we do, borrowing money is inflationary, okay? So if you have a bank and they only have to have 10% of what they're loaning out, that means they can loan $90 out that doesn't exist anywhere until they write that check to me who took out that loan. So that increases the money supply. Nobody decides that. It's just a function of fractional reserve banking. So the system is inflationary to begin with. But when you're talking about like monetary policy from like the Federal Reserve, it's not like they're going one day and they're saying, well, I think we need to have $21 trillion of money in the system. That's not really how it's working. What they're doing is they're saying, we need to spend more money. We need to borrow more money. Therefore, we're going to have to do these operations that are going to have the impact of increasing the money supply. So it's not like somebody's micromanaging the number, but as the decision-making as to, you know, we need more money or we need to spend or we need to borrow, those functions are inherently inflationary, and they can also be deflationary as well. So there's this weird combination of kind of market dynamics and government intervention that get all entangled in this web that in a lot of ways it's difficult to disentangle. And, you know, that's one of the hard things when it comes to like market analysis or economic analysis. There's so many factors that are playing together. It's hard to take one out and say it's done this, right? Take minimum wage, for example. We know from economic theory that if you have a minimum wage, a price floor for wages, that is ultimately going to end up with fewer people working. It's just, that's economic reality. But when you do that within the context of a huge economy, you may not see that impact immediately, right? You may have a decrease of employment because of that, but employment might increase in other areas because of other factors. So economic analysis is really hard. That's why it's important for people to understand basic economic theory, because you can hide things in statistics. You can hide things in data. But if you understand the theory, then you know certain things are happening, right? You know that if the federal government is creating more money, that there's going to be price inflation showing up either in consumer prices or asset prices, even though it may not show up visibly in the data because there's so much other stuff going on to kind of obscure or create a fog on the total system.
There's a lot of impacts on an economy, but there, you know, inflation is an impact, and it is, you know, when you do that, it does right. Change things.
Hey everyone, it's Doug from LCI. As you may know, the team at Podsworth Media has worked with us for a long time, producing our content for most of the Christians for Liberty Network. A big part of that over the past couple of years has been using the Podsworth app to make our audio sound clean, level, and professional, even when the raw recordings were super sketchy, like this one you're listening to right now. Believe it or not, this recording was that bad before I ran it through the Podsworth app, and you can hear the full before and after demo yourself at podsworth.com. The app recently got a huge update, and it's now better than ever. So good, in fact, that it can take almost any atrocious voice recording and make it sound great. Here's how it works. It removes background noise, cuts down on plosives, fixes clipping when your gain is too high, removes clicks and pops, reduces reverb, improves tone, and levels out the dialogue so that you don't get any crazy volume jumps. Everybody hates that in a podcast. Using it is super simple. You just go to podsworth.com and click Get Started, drag and drop the audio files, open them right up from your phone's browser, customize your settings however you want. But honestly, the default works great for most settings. And here's the really cool thing. If you enter code LCI50, you'll get 50% off your first order. No account needed, just your email and payment. You'll get a download link in your inbox with cleaned up files. It's perfect for podcasts, YouTube videos, sermons, audiobooks, you name it. If your recording sounds rough, the Podsworth app can make it not only sound listenable, but professional. And remember, when you use code LCI50, you get half off your first order, and you'll also be supporting the work here at LCI.
So, well, but thinking a little bit more of the Federal Reserve, so like I've heard, so the Federal Reserve is, correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, is not technically a government agency. It represents private banks. The president will appoint the chairman of the Federal Reserve. So there's kind of a relationship there. And what I've sort of heard, you know, people who's, you know, Fed chairman, people who support the Fed sort of say is, well, we're not necessarily responsible for inflation. Congress are the ones who come up with these budgets and spend all this money. And we feel sort of obligated in order to, you know, not shut the system down to print the money that will cover what Congress is spending. And so is that kind of what's happening or what's happening there?
Yeah, I guess probably what we need to do is we need to give at least a brief overview of how the Federal Reserve is actually impacting the money supply, because it's not as simple as, you know, somebody makes a phone call to Jerome Powell and then he goes down in the basement of the Eccles building and pushes a button and dollar bills start to run off of a press somewhere.
That is how Donald Trump seems to think it works, though, right?
Well, Donald Trump thinks a lot of things in a lot of weird ways. So that's a whole another marshmallow to try to unpack. But let me first back up and kind of address what is the Federal Reserve. And it is true that it is technically a private bank, and you will hear a lot of people, especially in libertarian circles, like to make a big deal about that. It's a private bank. It's not a government entity. I don't buy that. In my view, it's a government entity. It is doing the bidding of the government. It is part of the government apparatus. It is influenced by the government. The government is picking the people who are on the Fed. They're beholden to the government. They're while technically separate and technically independent, I don't buy that for one second. In my view, the Federal Reserve is every bit a part of the federal government as the Treasury Department and the Department of Defense. We can quibble over definitions and we can quibble over this notion of independence, but I don't buy it. One of the main purposes of the Federal Reserve is to support the federal government's operation in borrowing and spending. So how does it do that? Well, basically, it impacts monetary policy in two ways. We've discussed fractional reserve banking. We understand that when a bank can loan out money that it doesn't really have, then that is inflationary, right? We, you know, the bank has $10, so now we can loan out $100. So we're going to loan Mike Meharry $100. Well, they just created $90 out of thin air. So that increases the money supply in and of itself. So when the Federal Reserve tinkers with interest rates, when it artificially presses interest rates lower than they otherwise would be, this stimulates more lending. It stimulates more borrowing. That's the whole point of it, right? We're gonna lower interest rates so we can stimulate the economy. Well, it's also inflationary. So anytime the Fed is cutting rates, it in effect is unleashing more money into the system. So that's the first way. The second way is actually more direct, and it's what is known as quantitative easing. And in these operations, the Fed literally goes out into the open market. It buys U.S. Treasury debt. It holds that debt on its balance sheet. And when it buys this debt on the open market, what it does is it effectively writes a check from an account that doesn't have any money in it. So the Fed doesn't have to have money to write a check. I mean, imagine if you had this checking account and like you didn't have to have a balance, but you could write as many checks as you want. That's what the Federal Reserve can do. So it can go out into the open market and buy U.S. Treasury. So what does this do? It basically creates artificial demand for U.S. debt. If there's not enough people out there buying U.S. Treasuries, the Fed can step in and buy these treasuries. And then that kind of keeps the market nice and firm. And whenever you have a treasury, any kind of bond, any kind of debt, the price of the bond is inversely correlated with the interest rate. So when you have higher demand for a bond or for a debt, then the price of that's going to go up, but the interest rate is going to go down. So when the Federal Reserve runs quantitative easing operations, it's effectively increasing demand for that debt. It's holding the interest rates lower than they would be in the free market. And it's doing all of this by creating money out of thin air. That's how we ended up with $5 trillion new dollars in the system during the pandemic. The Federal Reserve literally bought that much U.S. debt, put it on its balance sheet, and then injected that money into the financial system. And then once the money's in the financial system, where it goes from there kind of depends on the economic and market dynamics. In the 2008 rounds of quantitative easing during the Great Recession, most of that money ended up staying in the financial system. We saw massive increases in asset prices. We saw a huge stock market bubble. I think the stock market increased by 130% between 2010 and 2019. When we had the pandemic, there were different dynamics in play. I mentioned already the fact that we had all of these people who weren't producing anything. We had the government showering that stimulus money on people so they could buy stuff. So we saw that inflation manifest in consumer prices, but it will always manifest somewhere. So that's really what the Federal Reserve is doing. It's not actually printing money. It's doing operations that effectively support the government borrowing and spending that is in and of itself inflationary.
So it's not a money printer go burr situation? It's a little more complicated than that?
Right. I mean, it is. That's the function, right? That's the end result. But it happens in a more convoluted way. I mean, I don't think it's wrong to say money printer go burr because that's what's happening. You know, that's the outcome wouldn't be any different if that's the way they were doing it. But it is helpful to kind of understand the dynamics behind it and why they're doing it. When you realize that the Federal Reserve is literally buying and holding U.S. debt, then it makes more sense of why they're necessary for the borrowing and spending.
Well, and I suppose maybe the difference between what the Federal Reserve does and something like a fractional reserve system where maybe a bank loans me money to start a business is that maybe they're kind of taking that money out of nowhere. They're sort of taking it from another customer. But the difference is maybe I start that business, I'm successful, I bring money in. And so then now that money, there's something behind it, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas what the United States government does with the Federal Reserve is it just sort of puts money out there and spends it. And there's nothing behind it. And so as a result of that, as you said, there's not like additional labor or additional stuff. There's just additional money. And so now all the labor and the stuff costs more without actually being worth more.
You sum that up perfectly for being the dummy in this conversation. That was, you hit the nail on the head. So in a sane financial system, even with a fractional reserve system, if you allow interest rates to respond to market pressures, when lending gets too high, interest rates would naturally rise, which would put a lid on that borrowing. So it would in effect regulate itself. But when you have a central bank that can step in and artificially push those interest rates lower than they otherwise would be, you're basically removing the restraints on the lending and the borrowing. So you end up with debt bubbles. It's why we have $37 trillion in federal government debt. It's why we have over $1 trillion in credit card debt in the United States. It's why we're seeing corporate debt at record levels, because all of this is being incentivized by the central bank. And I think people get a little bit confused because they think interest rates are like this kind of, I don't know, this mysterious thing. All an interest rate is a price. It's the price of money, right? It's the price of borrowing money. So if there's a high demand for money, interest rates are going to drop. If there's low demand for money, interest rates are going to rise. It's just like, you know, cell phones. If you suddenly had the government coming in and manipulating the price of cell phones, well, you would end up with all kinds of distortions in the cell phone market. That's exactly what we have in our monetary system. We have the government literally price setting, and the results are perfectly predictable. We end up with booms and busts. We end up with malinvestments that have to be cleansed out of the system. So the Federal Reserve, you know, it advertises, oh, we're going to come in and we're going to smooth all of this out, and we're going to make the economy hum along. No, it's creating a disaster because it's just socialist central planning is all it is.
Well, and there's a kind of a devil's advocate argument here, I suppose, that, well, you know, if we let the market do its own thing, then it really will be kind of wild and crazy. So we do want to smooth things out. And so then the argument is, well, you know, we will you know, lend money when it's needed, and we'll stop lending money when we that's conducive to the market. It's just, it's just a little fuzzy to me, so I'm trying to explain an argument that I kind of heard.
That is the devil's advocate argument. And it works because people think that money is somehow different than any other product. We know that markets will work because we see them work with shoes, right? We don't have the government coming in and setting the price of shoes. I mean, at least not yet.
Not here. Yeah.
But we know. I mean, we've seen impacts of price fixing and price setting from central planners across wide swaths of the economy. The key is money's no different. Money's no different than cell phones or shoes. So if you allow the monetary system to function, then it will work. Now, it's not perfect because we live in a fallen world, right? We live in a world where we're all human beings. People make mistakes. People do the wrong thing. And so you're always going to have bumps and jumps and ups and downs in any kind of economy because it's made up of human beings. But the idea that somehow these central planners are going to make it better than it otherwise would be doesn't stand up to scrutiny. And the real issue is that central planning always fails. The reason it fails is because there's no brain trust that is smart enough or has enough knowledge or can parse through that knowledge in an effective way to actually make a plan. We talked about how complex an economy is. You can't plan that. We're not smart enough. And it's really hubris and human arrogance that makes people think that there's some, you know, magic solution that these people are going to come up with that are going to make everything be perfect. It's just not a thing. We know that markets are the most efficient way to distribute goods and services. It's been proven over and over again. And yet, over and over again, people are like, oh, let's get the government involved. It'll fix it. Well, we see the results of the fix. And, you know, people want to go back to the pre-Fed days and they say, well, we had all of these booms and busts in the economy. Well, you know what? Government was intervening then just in different ways. So, you know, let the market work. It's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be better than what we have.
Well, and as I'm thinking about the argument that's sometimes made, and I think you've covered this with the central planning idea, but there's also maybe another issue here with like sort of incentives. So like what I think people would say is, you know, well, in lean times, we need to increase the money supply, right? But then when in fat times, when we've got everything we need, then we're going to start bringing it down. We're going to kind of pay for what we did before. And I think part of the problem is that they actually don't ever do that. They're always printing. It's not like there's never any sort of, what do they call that? Sort of a policy of kind of tightening the belts of austerity. You never really have the austerity measures. It's always just print, 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 print. So even if that idea worked, they're not really actually doing that, right? So that's at least part of the problem. The other problem is the central management idea, what Hayek called the knowledge problem, that, you know, no central planner is smart enough to be able to manage an entire economy because it's too complex. But like, but someone like Milton Friedman, who was, you know, libertarian friendly, but he was not like an Austrian economist. He was on the Chicago school that was a little bit more kind of focused on money and manipulation and looking at numbers and stuff, as opposed to sort of maybe general principles. That's kind of how I understand the difference anyway, is that he looked at the Great Depression, for example, and he said, well, that was the Fed's fault. But the reason that it was their fault was because they didn't print enough money. There wasn't enough money being put on the market. If they had printed more money, in that case, that would have resulted in, we could have averted the Great Depression. So his argument then is, well, maybe we do need a centralized currency, but we just need to manage it more thoughtfully. And you're not persuaded by that argument?
No, because again, I think it's arrogance and hubris. What is that right amount of money? Nobody can tell you that. You know, so much of this stuff in the financial world just made up, and it becomes kind of conventional wisdom just by repetition. For instance, 2% inflation, that's the ideal inflation target. I've never had anybody be able to tell me what is magical about 2%, because there is nothing magical about 2%. In my opinion, the reason they pick 2% is it's a level of inflation that most people will not get too angry with. Right. So, it's just nobody knows what these numbers are. And as soon as you start to think, I can outplan the markets, it's not going to work. And the other issue is that, you know, if you're relying on data, data always lags, right? We don't know that a recession is starting until much later, right? In 2008, in like the fall of 2008, nobody was saying there's a recession. Nobody knew that yet. And yet, if you go back and look at the data, we were. That's because data lags. So any central planner is always going to be behind the curve because they're relying on data that by the time they actually get it and parse it out, it's stale. And then, of course, if you're going to rely on government data, I mean, good luck with that. I mean, we've seen with the recent mechanizations of the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, you know, they literally erased almost 1 million jobs from the last year of job data with revisions. And it's crazy. You think about the way it works. You know, we get this report on the first Friday of the month, not this month because the government's closed, by the way, but we get this data and everybody reacts to it. Oh, we added 1 million jobs and everybody's, woo, we're doing great. And the markets move, you know, the stock goes up or whatever. And then the next month, they quietly revise that number down by 500,000 jobs. Nobody blinks an eye. You know, that doesn't get reported. So the whole idea, the human nature just rebels against any kind of central planning because, I mean, let's be honest, we're big dummies. And I don't mean that to be offensive, but we just, there's so much we don't know. And there's so much that we don't know that we don't know that central planning is always doomed to failure. And again, you know, I know markets aren't perfect. Markets have their problems. Markets are going to result with some people being poor. That's the reality of it. So we have to deal with those externalities. But to simply say, well, we're going to come up with a better system because, you know, these PhDs over here are going to make it work. Well, they haven't yet. You know, maybe AI will do it. I say that in jest.
There is a tendency, I think, sometimes for people to look at something that's imperfect and say, well, we have to do something about it, right? And then maybe what they suggest is not actually any better, but it's at least something. They're doing something.
Right. We're doing something.
So, you know, some libertarians are going to argue for like a gold standard where all our paper money is backed by gold. Others don't like centralized money at all. So they're going to say, well, maybe competing standards. Maybe we, you know, silver's in the picture, Bitcoin's in the picture. We're not going to have a government managed money. It could be all kinds of different things, right? Now, when I was in junior high, I was told that was the reason why the Constitution had to be written because the system we had in place prior to that was, you know, the Massachusetts had its own money. It didn't work in Rhode Island and it was just economic chaos. And it was crazy. Right. And so, you know, do you think one of these particular approaches makes sense? A gold standard, competing standard, you know, Bitcoin. I mean, how do you look at these things?
Yeah. If you're asking me for my perfect scenario, it would be a free market competition in money, which is how we got money in the first place. If folks are interested in kind of how money evolved, look up Carl Menger, M-E-N-G-E-R. He was an early Austrian economist, and he kind of came up with the whole theory of the evolution of money. Conventional wisdom is that governments create money and, you know, kind of impose it top down. And Menger very persuasively argued that it was actually a bottom-up evolution and that gold and silver rose to the top over, you know, years and years and years of use and trial and error. And they rose to the top because they were the best money at the time. I'm all for a free market in money where the best money can rise to the top. If it's crypto or Bitcoin, so be it. If it's gold or silver, so be it. I'm always going to be resistant to any system that has some dude somewhere trying to decide what is going to be best, because we always have to go back to that knowledge problem that Hayek so brilliantly fleshed out. So free market for money for me. Now, in the world that we live in, you know, maybe a gold standard would be certainly be preferable to the fiat standard that we have now. I mean, what we have now is the absolute worst possible scenario for the average, you know, person out there that's just trying to live their life. So, you know, if somebody came to me and said, "Well, we're gonna have a gold standard, and we're gonna, you know, reset the price of gold, and we're gonna link the dollar to it, and they can't increase the money supply except how fast the gold supplies," I'd be all for that. But I think ultimately a free market and money is the way to go. As with most things, let markets decide. And what is the market? It's just all of us together making decisions, right? It's kind of a hive mind, if you want to use that term. And I think that's the best way to make decisions, not trying to impose them with pointy-headed bureaucrats who really have their own best interest at heart, not mine.
So I've mentioned Bitcoin and crypto a couple times. You know, there are critics who are going to say, well, that's fake money, right? That's not real. It's not backed by anything. I mean, do they have a point, or are there reasons for libertarians to be skeptical of crypto, even though it's not a central currency, centrally managed currency?
I think there are always reasons to be skeptical of anything. I mean, there's downsides to gold. You know, there is no perfect money. What we're looking for is the best money, or I guess maybe we'd settle for good money. I think that Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies have a lot of the characteristics of a good money. Most importantly, they remain scarce, right? Government can't print them. The only really thing that Bitcoin lacks that, you know, purists might argue is an important element of money is having some kind of tangible value outside of its role as money, right? Gold has a tangible value. Even if it's not money, people want gold for jewelry. It's useful in electronics. It has a purpose and utility outside of its role in money. Most people who are monetary theorists will say that's an important aspect of money. Bitcoin obviously lacks that. It's nothing more than a digital number floating around in space. But I think you could also make a counter argument that maybe that's okay, given, you know, the technological world that we live in today. People that were talking about money, you know, 100 years ago couldn't have conceived of computers and Bitcoin and all of those things. So I'm not anti-Bitcoin. You know, I'm not Peter Schiff. I'm not going to tell you that it's worthless. I think it certainly has a value. I think right now its role is more of a store of value. It's not a very good medium of exchange simply because the transaction costs, they never seem to have been able to get that under control. But I'm open to, you know, Bitcoin being a money. I think it should definitely be in the mix of discussion when it comes to money. But, you know, I'm not one of these guys that's like, oh, Bitcoin is, you know, the final answer. I don't know. The other problem that I have with Bitcoin is that it's not tangible, that I can't hold it. And so if the internet goes away, where's my money, right? Or if we have a massive power grid outage, where's my money? Well, you know, I'm a Bitcoin billionaire. Doesn't be a bit of good if you don't have a computer. So I think there are drawbacks to electronic currency. But again, I'm all for allowing it to compete in an open market, and let's see which money wins.
Yeah, it's great. If the power grid goes down or whatever, then the Beanie Babies are worth more than the Bitcoin.
Right.
Yeah. So, President Trump, who I'll remind people, actually has a bachelor's degree in economics, has lauded tariffs as a means to make us rich. And a big part of the pro-tariff argument is that we have, you know, trade deficit with other countries. We buy more from them than they buy from us. And that this has an impact on the strength of our own economy. So, are trade deficits something that most economists worry about? And could tariffs be a way to solve that problem? Are trade deficits really an issue?
I don't think so. Again, you know, I'm going to put my free market hat back on. What is a tariff at its core? What is a tariff?
A tax.
Exactly. All right. Yeah. So I often heard Republicans back in the day telling me, we can't tax ourselves to prosperity. So I don't think trade deficits in a global system are nearly as problematic as some people might say. You have to look at both sides of a trade equation, right? Ostensibly, in a free market, if, you know, we're paying for goods that are coming from China and we're sending a bunch of dollars over there and they want those dollars and we want their products, that's really not a problem because those dollars are going to get reinvested in other things. So there's always a kind of a balance in that. And, you know, whereas we may have a trade deficit with another country, we may have a trade surplus with another country. So then things tend to balance out when it comes to trade. Now, I am sympathetic to the argument that, well, other countries have unfair trade practices, so we need to use tariffs in order to get better trade deals. That is somewhat of a compelling argument. But the notion that we're going to somehow make America great by keeping other people's products out of the country and relying on our own manufacturing, that's just economic illiteracy. Because, you know, there's the whole idea of that, you know, some people do things better than others, right? I am really, really good at writing articles about gold and silver. And I get paid nicely to do that, right? I can't fix my car to save my life. So I have a very significant trade deficit with my auto mechanic, right? But Money Metals has a trade deficit with me. So, you know, these things tend to balance out. Again, I think it's important when we hear the word tariff to understand it as tax. When they raise tariffs, they're raising taxes. And all of the bad stuff that come along with taxes are going to come along with tariffs. And I will, again, give the caveat for those who you know, think we should use it as a bargaining chip to get better trade deals. That is a legitimate, feasible argument, although I'm not sure that the methodology that's being used by the current administration is exactly the best approach, but that's probably a different discussion.
Yeah, no, as someone who's very opposed to tariffs, there's something about the logic of that argument that does sort of appeal to me a little bit. Say, well, we're going to threaten tariffs to get them to lower their tariffs. Right. The question is, has that actually been happening?
Well, and the crazy thing about it is, too, is they talk out of both sides of their mouth. On one hand, I hear apologists who recognize that this is a tax and they don't really like the idea of supporting taxes. So they'll use that argument. Well, it's a bargaining chip. But then out of the other side, out of the other side of their mouth, they're saying, we're going to be able to pay for the government and get rid of the IRS with tariffs, which incidentally is utter BS. I've actually looked at the numbers and that's not a thing. But yeah, so it's almost like they want to have both, have the cake and eat it too. They want to say, oh, it's just a bargaining chip, but then we're also going to fund the government with it. So you can't do both.
Yeah, and not just that we're going to fund the government with it, but there's sort of this idea that tariffs are going to make us rich. In general, like we're gonna have an American based economy. So there's this sort of idea that we're gonna keep tariffs forever. They're gonna make us rich. They're gonna make us a more domestic oriented economy, less interested in global trade. But also, they're going to create free trade with all the countries of the world. Right? And it can't really be both of those things. It's one or the other.
It's all very convoluted. Who knows what the goal really is? And you know, sometimes I just think these people aren't very smart. I mean, that's a possibility, right?
It's a possibility. Well, and I think a lot of the people who are making these kind of arguments are not necessarily in the White House. They're people who are trying to justify a policy that they've already agreed to support. And so you can make completely contradictory arguments for something once you've decided that, well, that's what I'm going to support no matter what. I'll use whatever argument
it's a way to assuage the cognitive dissonance.
Right. So as we're kind of getting close to the hour, running out of time here, maybe I'll ask just one question to finalize this, which is, what's one thing about money or monetary policy that you wish everyone understood?
Oh my gosh, there's so much. The first thing that popped into my head, and that would be a proper understanding of inflation. We have so convoluted the definition of inflation, and by we, I mean the government, academics, and the support system in the corporate media. They've effectively redefined inflation. If you go back to the 1970s or the 1980s and you look up the definition of inflation, what you will see is it was defined as an increase in the supply of money and credit. Increasing money supply was the definition of inflation. Everybody understood that rising prices was a result, a symptom of this monetary inflation. Well, today, we're basically defining inflation as rising prices. And there's all kinds of things that can cause prices to rise, right? We've heard it blamed on greedy corporations. I heard it blamed on Putin's price hikes. You know, and some people just like hold up their hands and go, well, I don't know why we have this inflation. I don't know why prices are going up. Or the notion that tariffs is going to create inflation. Tariffs don't create inflation. If you understand the proper definition of inflation, we have redefined a symptom as the illness. So all we're doing now is we're treating the symptom. It's like if I had a brain tumor and, you know, it gives me a headache. So I take Tylenol, makes the headache go away. And we say, well, I fixed it, right? We got rid of the symptom. That's not going to work. people need to understand that when the money supply is increasing, when the government is engaged in money printing, when the government is artificially lowering interest rates, that is by definition inflation. And then from that, you're going to get the symptoms. You're going to get rising consumer prices, or maybe you don't get rising consumer prices. Maybe it manifests in real estate, or maybe it manifests in the stock market, but you're going to get price appreciation somewhere as the result of the inflation. It just frustrates the fire out of me that everybody just says, oh, look, the CPI is up. That means we have inflation. You know, no, that's just a symptom. We're measuring a symptom. And it's useful to understand how that symptom is moving, but it is not the cause. We need to understand the root cause. And I am convinced that the reason that the powers that be have tried to redefine inflation in this way is exactly so they can obscure it, so that Jerome Powell can plausibly get on TV and say, yeah, we've got this inflation problem when we've got these tariffs and, Putin's price hike, you know, and they can point at all of these things without having to shoulder the blame, which is purely on the shoulders of the functionaries in the central banks and the government.
Yeah, that's great. Well, as you were talking about that, I was reminded of a meme, something on maybe Reddit or something, where someone was saying they're listing their monthly budget, and they're like, okay, I spend $200 a month on food and $800 a month on rent and $150 on utilities, and I spend $3,600 on candles. And they say, someone who's good at the economy, please help me budget this. My family is dying. And then some of the comments, spend less on candles, and they say no. And so there's this, I think, thing where we sort of, you know, when you're at the grocery store, you're not thinking about how much money is being printed. You're thinking about, you know, bread is more expensive than it was, milk is more expensive than it was. And there's this thing where you can go, okay, yeah, maybe, you know, this particular item that I get is a little more expensive because there's been a famine in some area where this, you know, this particular crop is produced. And so, but that's like a temporary thing that goes away, that gets resolved over time. Whereas the inflation thing, that's the $3,600 a month on candles. And right. That's what we should really be looking at, because these other things, they're going to balance out. It's going to get resolved at some point. But if we keep doing this inflationary spending, that's the $3,600 on candles. That's the thing that's really killing us.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. There's only one thing that causes all prices in an economy to rise in tandem, and that is monetary policy. As Milton Friedman put it, inflation is at all times a monetary phenomenon. And again, you know, lots of things can make certain prices go up. You know, let's say we have an oil shortage. Well, that's going to make a lot of prices go up because so much is dependent on energy. But the fact of the matter is that in an environment like that, if you're having to spend more on all of these things in a stable monetary environment, you're going to have to cut your spending on something else. So some prices are actually going to go down when you have these type of, economic price spikes. That's not inflation. Inflation is the entire price system moving up at the same time. It's like the tide, right? It's the ocean moving up. And you can have other prices, you know, waves that are going up and down on top of that tide. But it's the tide that really is key when it comes to understanding inflation. And people just don't get it. And so therefore, you know, they blame everything in the world for their problems except for the people that we should actually blame. And that's government.
Wise words from Mike Meharry. Mike, thank you for taking time to talk with us. Where can people find you and your work, what you're doing right now?
Well, I would appreciate it if folks would go check out moneymetals.com/news. And that's where you'll find most of my writing on these subjects. And I do about 2 articles every single day during the week and cover everything from, you know, gold prices to the Fed to inflation, all of these things that impact your money. So check that out. You'll also find over there at Money Metals, I do a podcast every week on Wednesday. It's called the Midweek Memo, and talk about stuff that we've just talked about here. And then also, if you're interested in such things, Money Metals has another podcast that runs on Friday, which is called the Friday Market Wrap. And generally, they'll do about 10 minutes, just kind of doing an overview of the week. And then we're doing interviews with various characters in the world of economics and money and investing and finance. For instance, this week I interviewed Daniel Lacalle, who's a Austrian economist who actually is a professor in Barcelona. I've talked to Jim Grant. I've talked to just a lot of really cool people. So you can check that out if you're interested in that kind of more interview format. But all of that's over at moneymetals.com/ news.
Thank you, Mike. I'll make sure I link to that stuff in the show notes. And two articles a day is a pretty crazy pace. So I'm hoping I'm not taking away from your time. You should be working. So
no, I'm done.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your time, Mike. It's been great talking to you. And I think this will be really useful for people like me who a lot of this is really kind of fuzzy and confusing. So
yeah, thank you for having me on. And, you know, it's a lot of this stuff is arcane. It's some of it's hard to explain, you know, in a interview setting or a verbal setting. A lot of this really, I feel like, lends itself more to a written explanation. So, you know, if folks have listened to something and they're confused or maybe they want a little clarification, welcome to drop me an email. My email address is mike.mehary@moneymetals.com. So just my name, mike.mehary@moneymetals, M-O-N-E-Y-M-E-T-A-L-S.com. And, you know, if it's a legit question, I will do my best to get back to you and answer it.
And I won't put that in the show notes to avoid you getting spammed by robots, but people who heard that might want to write that down. So thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group. You are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.